and in 20 countries. In the interest of disclosure, in 2008, I was contacted by engineers representing the city of Ferndale to provide a budgetary quotation for a slow sand filter for the city to meet requirements of the EPA surface water treatment rule. That's not what I'm talking about, though. People in Bellingham may be concerned about the Gateway Pacific Terminal's impact from train traffic. You should be concerned about our water. Putting aside for the moment all the other issues of the coal terminal, air pollution, asthma, vibration, climate change, if someone were to approach me and ask from a water perspective if putting a coal export terminal at Cherry Point is a good idea, I would respond as probably the worst use of that land I can imagine. There are two major problems I see. The first is supply. The second is stormwater runoff. And there's a slide there that I'll refer to. Multiple climate models, backed up by measurable declines in Mount Baker glaciers, predict that even though annual precipitation is likely to increase, summertime Nooksack flows will be down 20% by 2025 over 1990 levels and 40% by 2075. And these may be conservative estimates. The coal terminal will be using millions of gallons per day of Nooksack water during our 16-hour summer days to spray onto the coal piles to ensure specific moisture content, and in a futile attempt to control dust in a sometimes very windy location, water that could have better use. So let me explain a little bit about what the graph is. And I know it's small. Those are three summaries of three different climate models that were developed by Susan Dickinson, who was working on her master's degree at Western Washington. Now she's on the faculty at University of Washington. The green lines on each of those are the predicted flows in the Nooksack in the year 2075. The other ones, the black one, is current levels. So you can see in all three models that there are elevated stream flows during the wintertime, but during the summer month, you can see it dips down quite a bit. If you could hit another slide. Yeah, so higher flows in the winter, lower flows in the summer. That's what we can expect. Okay, next one. This is a slide of from the North Cascades Glacier Climate Project out of Nichols College in Maine, actually. And it's showing glacier, what's happening with Mount Baker glaciers. And you can see that since 1980, they've been declining really rather rapidly. Next one. And this one is also from that same study. And you can see the top two graphs, actually, with trend lines are showing precipitation rates and temperature rates. And these are historical, so they're from 1935 up to 2007. The bottom one that's declining rapidly is snowpack. So you can see that the models are backed up by historical data. Okay. During the winter months, hit one more. Okay. Yeah, this is from the U.S. Geological Survey, and it's just for a few months this last summer. Nooksack flows here, and you can see what happens during the summertime. So if you see the lower dip down the right at the bottom, if you can imagine, in 2075, it'll be half that. That's what we're looking at. Okay. During the winter months, there's a different water problem. Too much water. Evaporation rates in this area are way below precipitation rates. And if you can hit the next slide. I think it's the next one. Oops, one more. Yeah. So you can see on the left-hand side are precipitation rates here. And in the right-hand side is our evaporation rates. The difference between the two is the water that either goes into aquifers or flows off into aquatic ecosystems. Evaporation rates in this area are way below precipitation rates, so holding storm water is not an option. An 80-acre coal pile, so we're just talking about just the coal pile, we'll see 29 million gallons of excess water per year at today's level. And looking at the climate models, this number will increase over time. This water has to go somewhere, and it will go into local receiving waters and aquifers. Coal pile leachates can contain up to 1,000 times the level of aluminum that is toxic to marine organisms. Similar values of beryllium are carcinogen, and copper and algicide are present. Removing metals, which aluminum certainly is, and so is copper, requires processes like co-precipitation at neutral pH to be effective. Coal leachate is highly acidic with a pH of 2 to 3. Normal neutral water is 7. Low pH conditions prevent metals from precipitating. The GPT permit talks about treatment, but without detail, merely stating that a 36-acre treatment zone will be used. I am very doubtful that wetlands treatment, if that is what they plan, is able to buffer the pH or precipitate metals in anywhere near what is required in order to protect freshwater marine aquatic ecosystems, ecosystems that are critical to the vitality of the Puget Sound region. If they were to be successful at precipitating out these metals in wetlands and marshes, future generations at some point will be faced with wetlands and marshes with highly contaminated sediments. We don't have to look far for these sorts of legacies. They are oftentimes called Superfund sites. The problem of these contaminants entering aquifers is aggravated because metals in the absence of oxygen, as in groundwater, stay in solution and can travel significant distances in underground plumes contaminating existing groundwater. These contaminants then added an additional burden to water treatment facilities requiring co-precipitation and chemical processes to remove them. Water treatment facilities, which will already be facing increased salinity issues due to diminished summertime river flows and rising sea levels. These costs are part of the economic picture of the GPT proposal, though seldom stated. But make no mistake, the city and other rural users of groundwater, in order to comply with drinking water regulations, will have to pay increasingly to deal with these contaminants. And sort of in conclusion, we are entering an era of changing and diminishing water resources. That's just a fact. It doesn't matter if the trade unions, local politicians, Peabody, or Goldman Sachs have plans to the contrary. As we discovered last year with record droughts and Hurricane Sandy, Mother Nature always bats last. Times like these require long-range planning for vital resource utilization. Water-guzzling, wasteful, polluting projects like the Gateway Pacific Terminal run counter to the direction we need to go. I urge the city to explore every possible avenue to get out from under the GPT proposal, and further to plan for the most efficient, sustainable management of water for the coming decades, uses that maximize water reuse and recycling and minimize harmful waste streams. The alternative will be increasingly costly for the city and its tax and ratepayers. And actually, I think there's one more slide. This is hardly a local problem. This slide, also from Nichols College, shows glaciers in four different locations in the world: North Cascades, Switzerland, Italy, and Patagonia in South America. And if you look at the number of advancing glaciers in the left-hand column and the number of retreating columns in the right-hand side, you'll see how dramatic this global phenomenon is. We are facing global warming, and we need to plan for it. Thank you.
You deserve an applause for making that time. Well done. Okay, so we're going to move on to the subject that's going to be our main subject tonight, the discussion on residential densities, and I'll turn it over to our planning director, Yori Burnett.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Good evening, Council, Planning Commission, audience members. We have a subject before us that we have the opportunity to start discussing, in my opinion, before we desperately need to start discussing it. But it's a very important issue that really is the guiding issue in many ways for long-range planning in the state of Washington. Just a brief background, as you all know, the Growth Management Act, which was passed in the very early 1990s, was intended to change the manner in which jurisdictions in the state of Washington do long-range planning to make sure that we plan for future growth, not only saying how much growth will happen, but how will we react to it, making sure that our capital facilities plans reflect it, make sure that our zoning reflects it, and to a certain extent make sure that our community expects it. It was intended to change the way that we plan and the way that jurisdictions act, and it's been very successful in doing that because planning 30 or 40 years ago was probably pretty night and day to what it is now. It also adds a layer of oversight to jurisdictions where if it is determined through the courts that cities have not appropriately planned, there are pretty significant penalties involved. Whatcom County, we are a part of Whatcom County, but Whatcom County is experiencing pretty much the full brunt of invalidity for their planning. But within that, there are a number of different perspectives as to what is appropriate and what is not. And the state has pretty much deferred to local jurisdictions insofar as what their expectations are for the local communities. So there is local community rule, provided that local communities do plan. So our discussion today is intended to be focused on residential densities, and I'll start the presentation. Maybe. There we go. First, through the years, we have our different logos. There's the last one, created by our city clerk. The meeting purpose. We want to describe and discuss the overall concepts. Density is a complicated subject, and it's one that we're not going to get all the way through tonight. We don't expect to be able to get all the way through it tonight because probably everyone sitting around this table has a different opinion. Everyone in the audience has a different opinion, and probably staff does as well. We want to talk about the recent development trends and to figure out, well, is there a problem, or is this just something that is pretty academic and we can put it back in the box and maybe talk about it a few years down the line? Want to talk about potential short and long-term changes. If the Planning Commission and Council feels that, yes, there is a problem or at least there's something to be addressed, talk about, in general terms, what we can start to do about it. And we're going to provide you with some general options, which is going to be one of our takeaways. And again, we want to focus on single-family zones. Obviously, residential development includes multifamily development, but by including multifamily, it really expands the conversation more than what we could contain within this conversation right here. It's probably a good conversation to have later, but right now, let's focus on the single-family zones. The takeaways that we would like to see from staff in order to provide us a direction, to provide a direction to the Planning Commission and to give the community an understanding of what to expect coming on down the line is, first, is there a problem that needs to be addressed, or do we go on to other things? And then the level of review if there is a problem. Do we just do a code scrub where we continue to look at our zoning and update it where it's not maybe even evident to the layperson? Do we take more of a proactive approach where we do start to adjust our course? Maybe we don't reverse it, but we see that there's something on the horizon that we need to avoid or targets that we want to shoot for. Do we want to take the lead as a local small city and do maybe more than what other local jurisdictions have done? More could be defined by you. It might actually be less from some people's perspective. Or do we say, oh, my gosh, we didn't realize that this was a problem, and it is, and it's here, and it's huge, and do we need to take some pretty significant steps now to make sure that we can maybe get back on course? I wanted to start off with kind of a word of caution. Density is really a buzzword, and especially in Whatcom County lately, there are people on either side of the fence, where people will talk about density as being the greatest thing ever. Other people will talk about density and will assume that the people talking about density in the first place really want to get into their pocketbooks or affect their land. Those are conversations that can be had. They really don't help this discussion, though. From staff's perspective, we're not coming into it wanting to change things a great deal, possibly not even at all. So don't take that from anything that we say, that we feel that we are in some sort of a crisis. Also, on the other side, don't take it from staff that we feel that we can just ignore everything. We want to come up with good solutions for Ferndale's issues, whatever those may be. And we want it to be a good conversation where we can hear from the development community, folks who are smart growth, I guess maybe is what they would call themselves, and also the community that has already built and is already here and that feels that they are affected by the future growth coming in whatever way it might be. But please, if you do have those really political positions, discuss them, but understand that that's kind of getting us in the weeds a little bit more. Two areas of focus, really. One of them is, are our current codes, where we say that we want density or we want to have infill, are they actually restraining us from being able to accomplish what we say we want? Are they working against us, in other words? That's one part of it. And then the other one is, regardless of whether the codes are working for us or not, do we need to take another step as far as encouraging or even mandating certain densities? And hopefully those two issues will become clearer as we go through the presentation. First, I want to talk about some myths and facts. I don't know whether you can read it or not. I can barely read it from here. One of them, the myth that Ferndale's densities are very low. Density is a relative term, obviously. We're not anywhere close to Seattle. Probably pretty big news to everybody, but we're not Seattle yet. We're not even Bellingham. But the fact is that our achieved densities have increased from about 3 units per acre in when the Growth Management Act was enacted to over 5 units per acre now, and significantly higher than that when we're talking about multifamily. This is a significant increase. It can kind of get lost when you look at our overall average density, where you combine the densities over the last 20 years and the densities over the first 80 years. But overall, the city's growth has generally been to densify. Another myth, Ferndale's densities are still less than they should be. People can say that, and they might be right because that's their opinion. It is purely an opinion because there's no Growth Management Act bright line for densities. Each jurisdiction is different, and the various Growth Management Hearings Boards have said that. Growth Management Hearings Board is the court of appeals, basically, that these issues go to. There had been, for many years, a 4 units per acre bright line, where if that meant that was an urban density, and urban densities are good in the lexicon of the Growth Management Act. But that has been overturned because they said within the context of each city, less than 4 acres might be appropriate. And almost certainly in any city, you will have zones or areas that are less than 4 acres, and it's perfectly appropriate. Edgemoor in Bellingham is one example. There are up on Church Hill, we have a lot of other ones. That's a part of the urban environment, and that is understood that that's okay. Another myth. Recent growth trends can be depended on to predict future growth. So in other words, over the last 10 years, we've achieved over 5 units per acre. Therefore, in the next 10 years, we'll continue to achieve 5 units per acre. That's really not true. Maybe in Las Vegas or where you have flat and dry ground, that would be. But Ferndale is anything but flat or dry. And as we'll talk about many times in here, the flat and dry ground in Ferndale is probably already developed for the most part. So the remaining lands are more challenging. It's going to be more expensive to get those densities. it might also be in some ways impossible to get those densities depending on the specific topography of the ground. So some facts. Our comprehensive plan calls for specific average densities. Ryan just put up our comprehensive plan map over here, where in our low-density residential, we call for between 2 and 3 units per acre. In our medium-density residential, we call for between 4 and 7 units per acre. And in our high-density, we call for, I believe it's an average of 12 units per acre. We've seen that relatively high densities can be achieved if we have both the developer, the property owner that wants to achieve them, and land that allows it to be achieved. Yes, we achieve really pretty high densities. However, since the recession, and for some this might be a big breaking point or the reason for this, we have seen that we're achieving lower densities in the single-family zones when we're talking about the new plats that are coming in. Not the plats that were already established or the existing lots, but someone starting new since 2009 is generally seeking lower densities than they sought prior to 2009, between 2000 and 2009. And we know that our city codes, which in this respect have been in place since the mid-1970s and likely even before that, focus on minimum lot size. They focus on larger than average setbacks when compared to other jurisdictions. They emphasize wide roads where we have parking on the other side of the street plus the two-lane traffic in there. Those together create the potential for lower densities. Another fact is that the city codes really have no teeth to require higher densities. We had an issue relatively recently where we had a plat coming in that was to really low densities, maybe 1 or 2 units per acre. And we wanted to tell them, no, you can't do that. That's an inefficient use of the land that had previously been developed to higher densities. We talked to several attorneys, actually, and we said, can we do this? Our comprehensive plan says we're going to have between 4 and 7 units per acre in this zone. Can we do that? No, we can't, because that's a goal in the comprehensive plan. There's no mechanism to make sure that that happens. So even though we say we want to achieve between 4 and 7 units per acre, and we tell the county and we tell whomever else that wants to listen, that's our goal, and they say, yeah, that's your goal, what are you doing about it? It's the same as someone saying, I want to be president of the United States and I'm going to fight zombies on my computer all day. They're not really working towards achieving that goal. This might be Sam's opinion, too. When the zombies come. So I have a couple of examples for you. We have a property on Vista, right here on the west side of Vista. RS 6.5 zoning, which means 6,500 square foot minimum lot size. It's 2.5 acres, a little bit over 110,000 square feet. So when you look at the planned density, where what's the maximum that it could get, you divide that 111,000 square feet by 6,500, and you get 17 units. We don't have any minimum density. So what did they do? They subdivided it into 4 lots, which means a density of less than 2 units per acre or 4 total units. This property then achieved only 23.5% of the planned density. They got 4 units. They could have gotten 17. Several years back, Ryan, they actually got a preliminary plat for 11, 9 lots on there. So this is a significant reduction from what had previously been proposed, which even then was quite a bit less than what could be possible. So our questions to you, and I'm not expecting an answer at this point, and thank you so far for letting me talk. How can the city project future densities when the fully developed condition ranges so widely, where we see something where we say this could be 17 units, or this could be 170 units, or 1,700 units, and we're only getting 400 units out of that? How can we plan what roads are necessary, how to fund those roads, sewer, water, storm, when we simply don't know? How can the city plan appropriate infrastructure? And then how can we tell others that we can ensure that these are, in fact, isolated developments? Because I think that that's a response. Well, that's that one plat. They had their reasons for doing this. Maybe it was a recession. Maybe it was because this one had great views. Maybe it was because there were wetlands here, there, or somewhere else, which is correct, you know, in the context of that subdivision. But what if this other subdivision has different issues that result in the same thing, and this one too, and this one too? All of a sudden, we're talking about a really significant amount of possible land in our city that's being developed to these lower densities. Another example, this has more to do with the code issues. This is a property over off Malloy, the north side of town, over by Glacier View Park. 16,740 square foot lot size. It's in the RS 8.5 zone, so it has 8,500 square foot minimum lot size. There's 17,000 square feet required for two. You can see there's a house on there, and there's a big backyard. The maximum density is only one unit. They cannot subdivide because it's 260 feet too small, square feet too small. That's about 1% too small. They're not eligible for a variance because there's nothing in our variance that says you have the right to subdivide. They've already developed the property, and I'll acknowledge that it would be difficult to get something back here. But they've already gotten the quote-unquote full use of the property. This took me about 15 seconds to find this example. There are numerous other examples throughout the city where either due to the topography, the shape of the original lot, the various sizes, we have these large parcels that are so close to being able to subdivide but cannot and will not be able to be subdivided. That takes out a whole bunch of potential inventory, because we're not just talking about lots that are already subdivided and already built on. We're talking about lots that are vacant, where when they develop, there are these big remainder parcels that have to be attached to other lots to make them that much bigger. So what? Why are densities important? Well, from the Growth Management Act, there are four primary issues. The efficient delivery of services, the ability to plan for future growth, the avoidance of sprawl into sensitive areas, meaning both on the lot, wetlands, critical areas, that sort of thing, and then outside of it into agricultural lands that are outside of our urban growth area. And this is something that the Planning Commission really brought up a lot, the sense of place, where we want the preservation of rural areas, yes, but then also the creation of an attractive and varied urban space. We talked to the Planning Commission about going immediately to a maximum lot size. And Planning Commission said, and I think they rightly said, well, gosh, if you went to a maximum lot size, yeah, you might fix that problem, but then you end up with a cookie-cutter urban space where everything looks the same. You lose the interesting parts where there are large properties. You lose the attractiveness potentially for more affluent people who might want larger lots or bigger homes. But we can't ignore this. The state law requires that urban densities be achieved. While it doesn't define them, it does require that we ask these questions. So, is the sky falling? No, but we don't believe it's a time to put our heads in the ground. That if we said there's not a problem now, we might be right. But if we then wait for 10 years, there might be a problem, and our options, your options, are going to be that much smaller. Right now, we have a lot of different options because we don't think that there's a crisis yet, and really there's not a crisis. But in 10 years, we might see that there really are hard decisions that need to be made that are more than just code scrub. I said earlier that most of the dry flat land is gone, and for those of you that have tried to build recently, you know that there's more and more things that you need to think about. Uncertain economy, building fees, traffic impact fees, wetlands, all that sort of stuff adds to the development costs, and it also potentially reduces what you can do on a piece of property without spending a lot of money or going out into the county or a number of the other options you might have. Now here, you're going to see some transitions in these maps. And we're looking generally, not at specific properties necessarily, but generally. In our residential zones, all of our residential zones, we have just shy of 900 acres of land. But when you take out the non-residential, these are where there's a church on a residential piece of property, or you have a stormwater pond or something like that, you lose about 200 acres. When you then take out the developed lots, the ones that have a house on them already, the ones that have a parking lot on them, so on and so forth, you go down to under 500 acres. And then when you take out just the wetland areas, not lots with wetlands, but the actual wetlands areas themselves, you get down to 358 acres. We also show a number of subdivisions throughout the city that have been previously proposed for long plats, the bigger subdivisions, and have now been proposed for short plats. This is over the last 5 years. Either proposed for short plats or completed short plats or significant talk where they've gone back to the bank and now prospective owners have come in, and it's predominantly new potential property owners saying, I want to subdivide this into a short plat. So the blue, you know, you can say that there's not a lot of land, but gosh, it's quite a bit of the city. So we have 894 acres of, in theory, developable land, and 358 acres of good developable land. But when you look at that 358 acres and where it's located, there's really four properties there or four areas. And if you take those out, let's say the property owner doesn't want to develop or that they want to develop to lower densities, an argument could be made that we have less than 100 acres of developable land. And if we only have that much, or even 200, even 300, can we say that we can ignore densities? So what are our options? We've got four doors and an exit. Exit first. We say statement. This would be you telling us and the general public that this is what the city believes. That, yeah, we are achieving target densities under our current codes. We've considered other options. We're going to have this conversation tonight. But at the end, we've determined that no changes are necessary at this time. The code scrub, the statement. Well, while Ferndale is achieving target densities, we should take reasonable steps now to allow development to make efficient use of available land. Many of the city's regulations and design standards predate GMA and may not reflect density goals. Updates to setback requirements, minimum lot sizes, design standards, the ability to perform off-site mitigation, and more will be considered through the Planning Commission process and then to council. Possibly we have another joint meeting. That's up to you. The city will monitor achieved densities but will not pursue minimum density requirements at this time. Proactive. Ferndale's achieving target densities but may not meet density expectations in the future. The Ferndale Municipal Code provides the ability to achieve higher densities, and while changes to the code may also be necessary, the city must now identify mechanisms that will ensure densities are achieved. What those are, that's what we will talk about now and into the future. Better to look at the conditions and diagnose a solution at this point. Take the lead. Ferndale's residential densities have increased over time but are not yet adequate. The city shall consider amendments to the code that may restrain density but will also seek to enact minimum density requirements that reflect long-term goals. A little bit more than the last one, than the previous one. The last one. Ferndale residential densities have increased over time but are not yet adequate. Development trends suggest that the current codes and policies are insufficient to maintain compliance with the Growth Management Act and city goals, and that immediate action is necessary to prevent further low-density development. Immediate action could be something as significant as a moratorium on development that doesn't meet density goals, maximum density requirements, prohibition of annexations in the future in order to mandate that the only place to develop is through infill. So we're almost done. Again, wanted to describe and discuss the overall concepts, go over briefly the recent development trends, do we have a problem, talk about potential short and long-term changes generally, and again, focus on single-family zones. So that is our presentation. Relatively short because we wanted to give you a chance to discuss. Happy to answer any questions, but Rui, this is you. What do you think?
So before we have a discussion, do you have any specific questions for you at this time? Councilperson Mutchler and Councilperson Zimmerman, so I'll go in that order. Here, I have a population question for you. When we're calculating potential lots, are we including streets? Lots have to be at least 85,000 feet. So let's say we have 2 acres, about 85,000 square feet. In theory, we'd like to get 10 lots. But you had to put a stormwater pond, you got to put a street in, things like that. Is the calculation based on the whole parcel or the final? How do you calculate? We're not considering it, and we should be.
We should be, and we have moved in our definitions from taking it as gross density, where you take the whole 85,000 square feet and say, well, how many lots did we get out of that, to looking at net density, where we take out first the storm ponds and things such as that, and then we end up really at looking at the lot sizes that we're achieving. Now, so if each of the lots in there are 8,500 square feet, then we would be able to get those higher densities. If the lots on average are 10,000 square feet, obviously we get lower densities. Now, that's how we calculate it, really for the purpose of Bean County, I would say. Realistically speaking, the roads and stormwater and wetlands take up land too. And so there are opportunities to say, well, gosh, how can we make more of that 85,000 square feet actually developable while still, you know, protecting wetlands and doing all of our other requirements? And there are ways to do both. Correct. And the numbers that I gave you, though, the 125 or 150%, that's just the lots. That's just the lots, not counting any of the other stuff. Where because you don't have square and flat properties, you end up having to have a lot that is 9,000 square feet in order to make a curve in the road. Or 17,000. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Good question.
I get this from the History Channel of the Roman Empire. They had 50,000 people. That was their goal. After that, they moved on and started another. Because there is a finite number that we're kind of thinking ahead of how many people will burn up. What's the ideal number?
Yeah, and that's a really great question. So Growth Management Act requires that Whatcom County take what the state gives them for expected population increase for the county over the next 20 years. So we're talking 20-year increments. And of that, certain portions are allocated to the different jurisdictions. I think that Ferndale was given an estimated 9%, and I might be wrong about that percentage, of the total population, which is about 8,400 people, new people, over the next 20 years. So that brings us right about to 20,000 people. So, and that's the thing. The expectation is that the city in its urban growth area and city limits can accommodate 20,000 people, which obviously we can. Theoretically, we could accommodate 20,000 people in one 100-story structure in theory. That's not realistic. It's probably just as not realistic to say that we're going to accommodate all 20,000 of them in 20,000 separate single-family residences. It's somewhere between the two.
20,000 is the number.
Yeah, which is an 8,000 plus or minus increase.
So I have Planning Commissioner Cole, then Planning Commissioner Moore, and then Councilperson Watson. So I will start with our chairman.
In your slide, you used the example of the lot that could have supported 17 units and ended up only having four.
Yes.
Could you give me some idea of why that decision was made? I need to understand why a person that has a piece of land that could support 17 units or choose to only go four.
That one was an interesting one. That's the Scott Moore short plot. And as I said, every development decision, everybody has different reasons. Apparently what happened was this plat, which was originally proposed back in 2005, 2006, that had the 7 or 9 or 11 on there, for whatever reason was returned to the bank, I believe. This was the house that burnt down.
I don't know that I'm asking so much for an absolute slight specific reason,
okay.
But the reason why a piece of property that could support 17 developed.
What we've heard most consistently is two things, and Ryan, correct me if I'm wrong. One of them is that's where they believe the market is for relatively larger lots. The other one is that a short plat up until last year had to do significantly less infrastructure improvements than a long plat. So there were two things there. We've solved, I think, one of them last year with the code scrub, but then the market, the development community, I think, was trying to find bottom, trying to find where the market was. And we've had a lot of residential growth in the last year. I don't know if they've found where the market is, but certainly there is a market right now. But we do still keep seeing these short plats come in where people think that it is the market. Ryan Morgan Estates came in.
Well, is it fair to say that in at least those two instances, both of them were the result of a loss of the property and the reacquiring of that property, theoretically at a lower price? Therefore, you don't need the yield, so you could theoretically take the path, easier path of less infrastructure and still get a decent. I'm throwing this out as it seemed like that was at least in those two instances, one of these turn it, flip it. You know, my expectations change when you get it for a third of the price.
Absolutely. And I think something else that's common is the folks that have proposed a lot of these plats aren't developers per se. They're property owners that think, Oh, this is cheap, flip it, maybe not develop it. But they're still creating the lots. Those lots are on there. And they can be bought and sold, and they're a mark on the land.
Thank you.
Commissioner Moore?
Half dozen, a dozen? And that's the thing. Back in 2009, when we went through the whole UGA thing, and the county or other groups were saying minimum density, minimum density, and you might remember we pushed back on that hard. We said that was ridiculous. We didn't need to do that. we're here because over the last 5 years, that's what we would have assumed too, is that it would gravitate towards the higher densities. But then when you keep on seeing the same things popping up with the lower densities, that ceases to be an isolated incident and it starts to really look like a trend. We're not seeing that it's stopping necessarily either. I mean, like Morgan Estates was applied for in the last month or two after we had historically high residential development. So I don't know why it is. And it, maybe it's a whole bunch of isolated people making the same decision separately. I don't know. I would think that it already developed lots, for the most part, it's very difficult to then redevelop, but protecting that from happening in the future where maybe some people that are already developed could make use of it, but seeing whether or not we can avoid that somehow. Yes, except for any code scrub or any change, if all of a sudden we reduced it where that person could subdivide, more power to them if they want to. They're subject to the regulations in place at the time that they apply. And that's up to Council and Planning Commission as far as how far you want to go.
Commissioner Black? One of the things that it does is it puts responsibility on the property owner. Goodrich, but before that, I'm going to shift a little bit. Is I'm going to bring Mr. Sorensen up, and I'm going to go back to that question of some of you asked, well, why would someone build to that? And so I want to get an outside perspective. So, Mr. Sorensen, we're going to borrow your expertise for a couple minutes.
All right, great. Thank you. My name is Lyle Sorensen. I'm with the Mollia Group here in Ferndale. Prior to that, I spent the last 25 years doing civil construction with D.L. Sorensen Construction. So I've been involved in building plats. I've been involved in real estate development. There are a number of things that developers look at and people in the industry look at when they're developing property. When we go in and look at a piece, there's a piece I've got a client looking at on Churchill, the old Larson place on the end of Honeycutt there, for example. We could put 12 units there. Or 8, actually, now. We could put 8 there. But when you take into account the time it's going to take, the money that you're going to spend on engineering, the increased improvements for stormwater, curb and gutter, all of the infrastructure things, it comes to a point that for your return on time and investment, the only thing that really makes sense for that particular piece of property from a fiscal perspective is to divide it into 4 pieces. So I think it's about a 2-acre piece. So you're going to basically put the house on a piece and you're going to create 3 other lots. You're going to short plat it. You're going to get it done in a reasonable amount of time. And your return on investment at that point, at that level, is what makes sense. One of the other things that factors in a lot in development, we run into it in Ferndale, we run into it in Bellingham and other jurisdictions, are upfront impact fees. All the municipalities now are front loading. So we get people coming in from outside the area wanting to do high-density developments. And they run through it. They love the property. Okay, this looks good. This looks good. They start running feasibilities, and they go, oh, hold it. It's going to be $13,000 to $17,000 a door for our development. No, we're not going to build this 55 and over assisted living complex in your community because it just became unfeasible because of the front-loading of all the impact fees. And so those are all factors that come into play. It's about a fiscal decision. You know, as much as we all want to get high density and we all want to do stuff, you have to do what makes sense in terms of return on investment. You know, so that's really what it comes down to. It boils down to economics, the development standards that are imposed. You know, if you want to incentivize higher density, reduce impact fees for those kinds of developments. You know, take a look at how can we partner with developers, have me partner with those kinds of people to make it more attractive to do density. I've got another associate who's been working to do, I think 100 or 200 apartment units over on Cherry. It's a good size project. You guys are probably familiar with it. I had a conversation with him. And the process is frustrating. You know, the amount of checks and the volume of money that somebody has to put up just to talk about doing a project like that before they break any ground, it's a huge commitment in terms of finances. And so if we can do that, if we can adjust and not front load that stuff, I think a lot of developers and a lot of these people coming in who would like to do higher density, they're not necessarily opposed to somehow that being structured so over time the city's picking up those things. But when you front load it, they throw their hands up and they just go, look, you know, the cash to do this high density doesn't make sense. So that's, you know, those are pretty much the factors. Do you guys have any questions? Anything
yeah,
I can help with?
Questions from Mr. Sorensen before we move forward? Councilperson Zimmerman and Commissioner Kennedy. So I'll go.
Sure. You can do that. So you've got a site that's overly wet or that's got terrain factors or whatever, so we want to move density. Yes, you can. But it still comes down, at the end of the day, it comes down to the impact fees and it comes down to the costs associated with it. We can move all the density to 2 lots and build a high-rise, but really it doesn't make sense to build more than about 6 stories in Whatcom County because of the cost of the land. So, you know, there's always those balancing fees. That is always an option in terms of, you know, maybe working around some things. And some of that comes down to, again, working with the city and stuff on what makes sense for them. And, but, you know, flexibility is great.
Okay. Commissioner Kennedy?
Yes, sir. Are you familiar working with impact fee credits?
I haven't worked with those specifically.
Okay. Because with what you're saying about a, you know, it being a financial decision, and having spent many years in the development community myself, I've had good luck with impact fee credits to reduce that front end cost.
Right.
Open the door for developers.
Yeah.
And have kind of a balancing act as you develop many stretches for 3 or 4 years.
Right. Yeah, I think some programs, like anything that you can do to incentivize people to, you know, to step out and do some higher density things. There are people from outside the area. I know that's an evil thing to say, but there are people who want to invest money in our communities if we're willing to work with them. And a lot of them are open to higher densities. So that definitely is a tool.
Okay, any more questions?
I'm sorry.
Yes.
You said that building something over 6 stories in Whatcom County doesn't make sense because of the cost of land. Is that because cost of land is too cheap?
That's correct.
Okay, that's
as cost. your structural costs increase, and
right.
it's cheaper to go out and go up 3 or 4.
And that's generally true, you think, around the county and more places? I mean,
yeah, Bellingham's the same.
Okay.
Unless
you're
in the downtown core.
Okay, that's interesting.
Or Western or wherever. Yeah, it's a function of, you know, we've done feasibilities and things on some 10-story to 20-story towers and stuff in Bellingham. And most of the time, because of the land cost, it doesn't make sense because of the increase in your building costs.
Right.
Underground parking and things.
Exactly.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Do you want to bring that back to his statements?
Well, I just wanted to say that in itself is indicative and plays right into the density question, because if this was New York City or Bellevue or what have you, they go up because the land is so dear. And to the extent that we can continue to slowly and incrementally sprawl outward, really, and find more flat, dry land, we'll never drive the price of the land high enough to drive the market for vertical density. So there's probably some reasonable outer limit that we should consider in the foreseeable future.
I think part of it, too, is a cultural thing that you have to understand between a dense urban culture and more of a rural type of feel. And I think you have to kind of balance that out with your community.
Right.
You know, as planners, we can say, well, this is how it's going to be, and everybody's going to move into a 10-story tower now because, you know, we don't want any more flats, you know, spreading out around our area.
Mm-hmm. But
the fact is,
okay, thank you. There were a couple of things that I found interesting, and I don't disagree with. We're one of the only jurisdictions locally that splits the impact fees 50% at plat recording and 50% at the building permit, and we've since extended it so you can do it prior to final occupancy. What we hear on the flip side, though, and Ryan deals with it much more than me today, in fact, oh, my gosh, this is from someone building a house. The lot's already established. You mean to tell me that I have to spend $13,000 for my door? Why didn't you have the developer do it who created the lot? So I think that it's the fee payment period. No one wants to write checks, and not to say that that's not a very valid point, though, but we see it at both ends. The other thing that I was going to say, I was talking to one of our council members today. Right now, our ratio of single family to multifamily is about 4 to 1. You get 4 single family for every 1 multifamily unit. I would expect that over time that's going to reduce, where probably in Seattle it's the reverse. Maybe it's 1 to 4, maybe it's 1 to 10, 10 multifamily for every single family. Maybe in 20 years we end up where it's 2 to 1, single family to multifamily. But I think that within the foreseeable future, probably within all of our lifetimes, single family is going to remain the predominant type of residential development in Ferndale. I just don't think that we're going to reverse course or whatever, no value statement added to that, within our lifetimes.
So. Okay, thank you. Great patience, Councilperson Ingram. We hope you remembered what your question was.
I don't know, I'm pretty old and crutching. Gloria, I'm going to ask you just a couple of little things. Because I was asked it just last week. Have a piece of land that was originally platted for 9 lots. It's now 4. I was asked by somebody if they could buy 2 lots and earn it, but they put 1 house in.
Yes. Yes.
That to me flies in the face of everything we're trying to do here. If we're going to say we want to create this density, it shouldn't be a goal so much as a requirement. If we don't have any teeth in our ordinances to enforce it, why do we have it there at all? We need to have some teeth in those ordinances. We need to be able to tell a developer, you need to develop this land to a density required for the city. Because if we want to control what our city's going to be looking like in the next 20 years, we've got to have the control. We can't just turn it loose and let these people do anything. And so here's a whole bunch of places that are roughly a little bit. They've got curb cuts for the driveways for every house. They've got utilities stoked up and they've got dirt for every house. And you're telling me that we actually could let somebody buy 2 of those lots side by side for 1 house.
Mm-hmm. No.
I find that absolutely mind-boggling. Mm-hmm. To
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Can we get 1?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Allow, before let's pull back here. We're going to have a lot of conversations. Would you care to respond to that?
I don't know if there is a mechanism that we could prevent someone from acquiring 2 properties and straddling them, that there probably is. But it does happen quite often where someone purchases 2, puts them up right in the middle. Sudden Valley, that happens all the time. I think that there's at least one instance, I believe, where someone's bought a whole subdivision and put up just the 1 house. That's the other issue, and where we circled the different properties on there at 4, we can't compel someone to develop, period, which is kind of the flip side. Someone might just decide not to put their house out on the market. We can't compel that.
But I find it strange that after the plant has been developed, the roads are in, the utilities are in, everything is there for a specified number of lots, and somebody can change the game. I understand why.
Well, I know that Commissioner Black has something, and he might have a different perspective. But if separate parcels are for sale, a potential property owner, there's nothing that we could do to prevent them from buying both of them and then building on one and leaving the other for their yard. That's a private market thing that I don't think the city has any ability to.
Okay, our clerk has a clarifying question for the minutes for you.
That was what I was going to see clarification on. It's not that they can put a home right in the middle of two lots.
They could.
That they put
could.
The home on one lot.
No, they could.
A few lots, for instance, on church.
They could put one, and they could do a covenant to bind the two properties together and straddle the
they
property.
Straddle.
Well, and in fact, you know, we're talking. We all have a concept of a 6,500 square foot lot or 8,500 square foot lot. Nearly all of Fairhaven, most of Griffintown, are on multiple lots because at that time might be apples to oranges. They created lots that were 10 feet wide and 100 feet deep. So they are all straddling legal lots of record. It's an issue of what the magnitude is, but I don't believe that there's a mechanism that we could prevent.
No. Legally.
Still in America.
Yeah.
Good America. And then back to Commissioner Glass. One thing I look at this as, if we were sitting here in Ferndale was just a big open spot and we were coming up with a planned community, I can see how a lot of this discussion would make sense. But Ferndale has developed over the years. There are these little pockets here and there of vacant land. There's topography that has to be taken into consideration. And we're sitting here trying to define, you know, what's going to go on an acre of land or three quarters of an acre or whatever these little pockets are, and say, well, we decide, and I can kind of go with the minimum idea of Commissioner Black of four, but that may not work for the whole city. That may work in this instance here, or may work in this instance over here, but up on top of the hill or up on Church Road or someplace else like that, you may be lucky to only get two on the acre because of the topography or the wetlands or something that comes into play that we don't see. And so how we as a body of commissioners and council members can say, this is the stamp for Ferndale, apply it to everything, I don't see how we could do that. And, you know, justly treat everybody fairly throughout all the different properties. How you deal with that issue, I don't have a clue of how you would answer that other than to say, this is a goal, four units per acre, but use it as a goal versus a mandate in an ordinance, and then leave it up to the developers, whether it be fiscally the thing or through topography. I just don't see how we can apply the same rules to the whole city.
Basically what we have now. Commissioner Black?
Yeah, I wasn't proposing
would a minimum density even stop that?
It could.
there's a house.
Because you have to meet the minimum density.
Well, that was the guy that developed the plat had to meet the density.
Because the density as it stands now is not in code, it's in a code measure now, and it's a suggestion. It's a goal.
Well, where does that fall into? Is it the developer of the plat that's required to make the density, or the builder of the house?
They'd probably disagree, but the developer of the plat sets the table for it. If the table isn't set, then it won't be created by the property owners that come in. There's probably going to be some attrition almost no matter what we do. If we have a 100-unit plat, maybe we only end up with 98 units, but that's probably better than a 50-unit plat only ending up with 46 units, the same percentage. So I think that setting the table is the goal, knowing we're never gonna get 100% efficiency, and we're never gonna have every lot filled. But it's probably more efficient than what we have now.
Okay, I have Councilor Hansen, and then Commissioner Czar, and then a very patient member of the audience.
one of the figures that caught my attention. Rory was going through the presentation was the increase in density from 3 to 5. Over what time frame was that?
The 3 was based on, I think, the city's comprehensive plan, or maybe the county's comprehensive plan from 1989 or 1990 to now.
By the point of the recession, it did an increase to 5.
2009.
Okay. We all know what drove it. Economics drove that. Mm-hmm. Right now, we are coming out of an economic slump where there's been a bit of reversal. I caution us, all of us, to be careful that we don't take a 2 or 3 year trend and now start changing the rules to fit that, because 3 years from now, it's going to be different. The other caution is I've listened to the minimum density argument. I get a little bit nervous about if I own an acre of land out here that's vacant, it's not been platted, it's an acre of land that's in the city, and I walk into City Hall, no one's proposed this, but all follow me through. And City Hall says, well, we're trying to achieve a 5 minute per acre density, so we're not going to let you build your house on your acre. No one's proposing that right now, except that if you divide the land, then you aren't proposing it. And you see the nexus, the next step is any parcel of land that's built on has to have a minimum density. We can't let you build on an acre, even though it's, I'm not talking about next year or 2 years from now, I mean 10 years from now, as the density thing is under our heads. And we now are so sensitive to the density that we're making everybody, even if he owns a 20 acre piece, just annexed his in, he owns 20 acres, help build a house there, because we have this minimum density. So I would caution, before we go too far. Last comment, I would prefer to let economics dictate most of that. I think you can improve the world. I think you can create a situation for the 17,000 square foot lot. I think you can add into your codes the ability to subdivide within a certain percentage so that the 8,300 square foot lot would work in an 8,500 square foot density. I think you can deal with those issues. I think that can be handled administratively or through some sort of zoning. The final point that I will make is just, we live in a diverse community. We live in people who have 6,500 square foot lots. We have one gentleman that I know of who lives on 5 acres. He's not even thinking about it, so I don't know how he got. Whether you have the 5 acres by buying several lots, whether you have 5 acres a lot. The point is, it is a diverse community. It's a rural community. And heaven forbid.
Well, you know, we haven't had a long plat come in with our new rules, but time period with a short plat, Ryan, you might be able to answer. What we found a lot is people coming in saying, well, since you're close to Bellingham, I know what your rules are, or I know what the timeline is. Where Bellingham's the bigger city, but I think that they say, I'm used to Bellingham, I assume that everybody follows Bellingham's lead, therefore Ferndale is Bellingham. And that's not the truth, and I think that Ryan frequently sees people say, well, gosh, this wasn't as bad as I thought.
Okay, I'm going to bring Linda from the audience and customers from Lexor, then I'm going to have our planning director kind of circle us back around. Welcome, Linda.
I'm Linda from the audience. I'm Linda Twitchell, and I work for the Building Industry Association, and I'm not here to lobby, and whatever you guys want to do for Ferndale is great, but a couple of points that occurred to me. Point one, if you do get into a discussion of delaying payment of impact fees to help people build affordable housing, part of the problem is you can't borrow that money up front, so the builders have to hang on to it themselves throughout the process, and then paying it up front becomes a bigger deal. Kitsap County is a model on if you want somebody who doesn't require payment of impact fees until their final inspection. And they've been doing it for 3 years. The Kitsap County Planning Director is more than happy to chat with everybody about it. That's one way to look it up if you want to see a way another jurisdiction's doing it. The idea of minimum density versus minimum lots, if you wanted to go to minimum density, one potential way of handling that is what's called lot averaging, which is not really PUD, but you assume that if you have a two-acre chunk or whatever it is you're dealing with, that you can then deal with the 150-foot buffers around the streams and the wetlands and the steep slopes and whatever by arranging your lot so that you don't have a minimum lot size, but given your area, you've got a certain density. That's a tool you can use to do that. If you want higher density, which you may or may not want, because, frankly, the impression we get is that people are building in Linden and Ferndale because they can do stuff here you can't do in Bellingham. And you're a 20-minute drive, and that's an acceptable commute. And a lot of what we hear from the home builders, the National Home Builders Association, is that the majority of Americans still want some kind of yard. They may not want the huge yard that people once had, but they want a yard, and that's becoming more difficult to get in the urban development areas like Bellingham. This is an advantage Ferndale has. You guys can attract people who don't seem to find that option in Bellingham, for instance. So, you know, these are all considerations. But I just thought there was one other tool I was going to mention. I can't remember what it is, but but anyway. Oh, I know what it is. I don't know if Ferndale does this at all. If you wanted higher density, one way to do it without creating the dense urban look is accessory dwelling units, which are becoming one affordable housing option in modern America as children get out of college and can't find jobs and move home, as older parents want to move in with the, you know, become a two-generation setup. It's a design standard thing if that concerns you. It's, you know, something you might want to look at, but that's another tool if you wanted to to increase density, to hopefully make housing more affordable, which is something the BIAWC is real big on. We're not talking sustained affordable, we're talking market affordable. But that's another thing you could consider that might not change the character of the community, but might allow you a little higher density where people feel it's necessary. So those are... Or putting a unit over a garage where the kid who couldn't get a job out of college can move in and not be on top of mom and dad. Or there are many different ways to handle it, you know, it, depending on what this community would want to do. But it's another thought. So.
Thank you. Yuri, can you, because I want to circle back, you mentioned one of the kids, can you inform all the commissioners, the audience, the changes we've had in terms of payment or those tax fees? You jumped on.
Yes, so 10 years ago, maybe more, we established the 50-50 split, where at the time of plat recording, you pay half of the impact fees owing, and then at the time of building permit issuance, you pay the remaining half. Over the last couple of years, and it was really initiated by the council, council member Goodrich, I think especially, upon hearing that that still presents difficulties, we have allowed developments to, when the building permit comes in, to defer half of their remaining fees, so half of the 50% up until the time of final inspection or occupancy. And then over the last couple of months or so, we've expanded that even further because we have determined that previously, some plats had said you have to pay this time and this time, but and that stopped a lot of the plats from being able to take advantage of the deferral program. We've since expanded it because we've determined that, in fact, that is not an obstacle, that if it's on recorded plat, even if it says 50-50, that is not an absolute requirement. So all plats can now defer 50% of the remaining until occupancy. Probably not as lean as you wanted it. I think that he was upset because of the sticker shock of the total amount of fees owing. And I think that in that case it was an older plat, so he was faced with 100% of the lots because it was close to where you live, Mr. Mayor, where it was a 1950s era plat.
Apart from what you do in the part of the city. I want you to clarify that.
Well, I guess I'm thinking surrounded by your estate. Now it's shrinking down to, you know, your house with your estate despite your the house, and it's more of an ornament than anything else. Yeah. But that's the same concept of your house in the middle of this lot. You know, it's very much ingrained in people, and people tend to want as much land and space around them as they can afford. You know, in fact, the issue of acreage isn't an issue.
Talk about short plats versus long plats. We say that short plats are cheaper because we don't require the improvements that we require for long plats.
Used to be. Changed it last year.
So are we requiring the same improvements for short plats as we do for long plats?
Yes.
Okay, so that particular incentive for short platting something that could be long platted no longer exists.
Time. For that time factor.
Now it's,
Yes, and it's down to time, and then also there's, you know, things such as stormwater where a short plat, you just simply have less of an impact, so you can get less done. And that's from the state regulation, something that we don't have any really input on.
Okay, right back to you.
So, yeah, just cycling back, I don't know the best way of doing this, whether head nods or raised hands or what. But what I'm kind of hearing is maybe less of a code scrub. I think that everybody agrees that there should be some changes. So we're certainly not at exit and we're not at brace for impact. I think that I was hearing more of in between proactive and take the lead. And so some of the things that people were discussing. Yeah. And that's fine. I mean, obviously we're not going to come up with all of the solutions today. We'll go through the process and we'll come up with them. And it'll be a multi-step process. From my perspective, one of the things that was the downfall of the infill toolkit in Bellingham is that it was a big document. You know, here's how we are solving density. And that's scary for anyone. You know, a multi-page, multi-section document saying that these are the solutions. That's change, and it's change all at once. I think that taking each of the things through accessory dwelling units might be something that we consider, and that's good. Other low-hanging fruit, setbacks, might be another. And that we eventually get to maybe if we did go in the direction of the the minimum density flexibility thing that, that Commissioner Black is talking about, that's going to involve not only community development, but public works and all of our different things working together to look at our development standards. It's a multi-step process. It's probably not going to be done this year. But so I guess, am I seeing head nods, proactive take the lead?
Without complete approval.
Without.
Code scrub and proactive.
Yep, I would agree.
Well, that's the line. I need to see it first. Get out there and start. Let wholesale change.
I think there's a lot of good ideas here tonight. I like some of these commission documents. Mm-hmm. And I think Nelson 100% correct. He says, you know, the economy's going to drive this thing. We've said that for years. About the fact that sooner or later, somebody's going to come in with a D9 and bulldoze half of this area down here off Cherry Street and build it all in. And that is going to happen someday when the economy is just a fine.
We've already got the plans on the books.
You don't want to do that.
No, I think minimum density just a valid point.
So you feel you have a pretty good idea of where to proceed?
I think that we have good direction that this is.
I don't completely agree that you're all ready to jump up and say, I like everything that you already said. But I think we've given him direction.
The conversation will not end now. It's good enough.
I'll ask him. Do you think the council will give you enough direction to move forward? Regardless of what Councilperson Watson says.
I think so. I mean.
Yes.
What? Yes, you have. I mean, we don't have all the solutions right now, but we have enough to start the conversation going and run it through the Planning Commission up through Council.
This was a great start. We never expected tonight to be an end-all. We expected tonight to be a start.
I didn't even catch that. That was a dig.
Okay, so...
I don't have anything more beyond saying that the public, you know, anyone that wants to can send Ryan or me an email if you've got great ideas.
I want to divert for a second is, and most of you have in front of you, we saw the letter presented by Councilperson Mutzer, some good ideas, some open discussions there. Staff liked some, didn't like some, that's great. If any of you have your own opinions that you want to submit those, or thoughts on John's, or thoughts on something else, please get them to Yori. But again, this is just a start.
Mm-hmm.
And a great discussion, great meeting, one of the better ones, and this will continue.
Do you have a time frame for when you'll bring it to the
No, we're not going to tell you. Actually, we have to set a date. Because, again, as we talked to, we are under no... to do this. In terms of the Growth Management Act and our comprehensive plan, we're okay. And we will be full. Our planning department is planned accordingly and
In 2016 is going to be a big year. We're going to be going through the process. 2016, that's when we have to update our comprehensive plan. We're starting the process, joint meetings with the county and all the other jurisdictions this year. So it might be that when we come to 2016, we see, gosh, actually we've had an uptick in density, downtick. Maybe we're staying the course, but we can then have that conversation. There's so many different ideas that were presented here, and it's great because they are all possible now. If we were 10 years down the road, we might only be at Brace for Impact or take the lead. But we're having this conversation when we should.
Yeah. Okay, so you're okay?
I'm good.
Okay, moving on.
Second.
Moving on the agenda. Okay, moving on the agenda. Again, you're all invited February 11th, 12 o'clock, Vista Middle School. Presentations on preventing teen dating violence, and the statistics are actually alarming even in our city. So that's at 12 o'clock at the Vista cafeteria of lunchroom, the big room that we walk in. No, it's a special program on the domestic violence program.
time in the mix. They're going to pull away from class. So we'll be presenting.
Oh, there'll be students involved.
It's completely about students involved.
Okay.
Yeah. The other one is for all of you here, you're all invited. It's in this room. It's Saturday, February 16th from 9:30 to 12. It might go longer. And it's a Whatcom. It's another exciting. It's a Whatcom County Vision meeting by the League of Women Voters. They will film it. And you'll have a panel of the mayors of Whatcom County with questions and answer up. What's the vision and where do we want to go? A completely new concept that no one has ever discussed before.
At 9 to noon?
That is, it starts at 9:30, goes to 12. But it can go later. Well, that's another thing that I'll discuss with council because the mayor's out of town that day.
Mayor Pro Tem is not available.
Well, I can find someone to take over.
Lunny's
were
obviously the fifth largest city or something.
All right, moving on.
What does it matter?
Any council reports? Councilperson Goodrich.
I just want to say I will not be here for the next council meeting.
Vacation denied.
Well, I'm sorry, but out of the three plus years I've been on the council, this is probably my second or third absence in that time. But my wife and I are headed to Hawaii to celebrate our 35th wedding anniversary.
We have our
30th. Any other council reports? No, commission reports. Any commissioners want to announce anything? Any exciting?
Congratulations.
Commissioner Moore has the prettiest sweater here.
Probably too fast.
Other than that?
Well, I mean, we're going to be at our tenth next year.
Yeah, what is with the heating in
there? Yeah. Well, it is funny because it seems like a decade ago that we first heard about the world. And it was 3 years ago.
No,
yeah.
We have not
and then other things
okay.
From
Farmer
years
reports.
Ago.
Funny commission.
Just. Nothing.
Okay, great. City Administrator?
Nothing.
Police Department? Nothing. Clerk?
Nothing.
Public Works?
Nothing.
I entertain a motion to adjourn.
Second.
All in favor, say what I say?
Aye.
Okay, everybody.